This is Making Docs. I'm Paul, an aspiring documentary film producer.
And I'm Caroline, a freelance documentary director. We speak to industry professionals to get practical advice on the filmmaking process.
In this episode, we visit Spring Films, who are a twice Oscar-nominated Emmy, BAFTA, Peabody, Grierson, and RTS award-winning factual production company based in London. They specialise in high-end, access-driven documentary and non-scripted content for clients such as Netflix, Channel 4, A&E, the BBC, HBO, ITV, the National Geographic, Sky, and many more. We speak with their managing director and executive producer, Richard Melman, to learn about how Spring Films operate and what the opportunity is for independent filmmakers to work with them. Hello, Richard Melman.
Good afternoon.
Just to set the scene a little bit, what do you call this room,
Richard? Our screening room, our cinema. We're very proud that we have a 20-seat screening room, 105-inch display with 7.1 surround sound. 5.1 is so yesterday, I find. And it's a huge boon to the company. It's not something we had before. And when you show films to people on your computer, they tend to look at their email, fiddle with a pen, do something. But when you stick them in a proper cinema, turn the lights down and put it up on the big screen, everybody watches. And we found that enormous benefit, particularly when we're showing commissioning editors or contributors. It really makes it more of a cinematic experience.
It's great, and it's perfect for podcasts as well. So.
And you forgot to mention the beautiful, colourful seats.
Oh,
it's really charming.
Multicoloured seats as well. Very handy for spilling red wine on. They don't show up so much.
And I do think it is a reflection of how far Spring Films have come as well, to have your own cinema room.
Yes. I mean, the first time we met, we were sort of all squished together in our top attic, huddled round a broken table. But bit by bit, we move forward.
That's right. And just for the listeners to understand, I met Richard, I think it was about maybe 2.5 years ago now. And Richard was kind enough to come and judge at one of the regular competitions that the Documentary Film Network that I run runs. And from that, Richard was keen to connect with the competition to offer up a prize, and that was a visit for the winning teams to come to Spring Films and now have the opportunity to pitch to Richard and the guys at Spring Films
which is very exciting, their productions.
Which is a really exciting opportunity. And ever since then, I've got to know Richard over that period, and I've got to see kind of Spring Films evolve slightly over the 2.5 years. And I suppose this is a good place to start, Richard. Can you explain the evolution of Spring Films?
Yeah, Spring has been around for quite a while. It was set up in 2006 by my CEO and his wife, but it was dormant. They never did anything with it. They had it resting there, and they both worked with another company. And then for a variety of reasons, their company that they were working for closed down. And as so often these things happen, I was having lunch one day at BAFTA, and I bumped into Andre, who is the CEO, and I've known Andre for best part of 30 years. And Andre said, "Oh, it's amazing, come and run my company for me." And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, why not?" And I said, "Because you're the worst businessman I've ever come across." And after a lot of discussion, he said, "Well, come and meet my chairman, because my chairman would love to get some ideas from you about what we do with Spring." So I said, fine. A few weeks later, I met with our chairman, who's an amazing guy called Sir Thomas Shabir. And Tom sat across the table from me and said, "So, why do you want to join Spring Films?" And I went, "I don't. I really don't." But after a few hours' discussion with Tom, I realised that he was someone who would absolutely have my back and we could work together very well. And so I agreed to come and join Spring Films, and that was coming up for 8 years ago.
So before you joined Spring Films was already a company.
It existed, but mainly in name only. And when Andre decided to sort of inject it with life, Tom helped find him an investor. And Spring owes a lot to an investor who wishes to remain anonymous, but they put some money into Spring to pay for our first few years of existence, really. One of the huge challenges about any independent company is surviving your first 3 years. Even though Andre and I have been around for a bit and we both have reasonable reputations, just generating the name Spring and getting people to think that we had made good programs and we were safe and secure, and if you gave us money, we'd probably be there at the end and give them a finished film in return, takes a while. And we had some lean periods and we had some slightly better periods, but it was that investment that really helped spring us into a position where we could pay for ourselves, so to speak.
That pays for the wages and your time to build a company, but also to inject it into projects that's going to get the company off the ground.
Okay. The biggest challenge as an independent is how much you spend on development. The more and more and more as we go along, the commissioning editors want more and more out of you, and they don't want to pay for it. They all want teasers. They all want to see something. You know, the Germans and the French want 26 to 36 page proposals. The Brits want a page and a half. The Americans want 12 pages. Have you met your contributors? Well, no, they live in Papua New Guinea, so we weren't thinking of popping down there. But you get more and more pressure. I think we all complain as independents that this is a challenge. And it's having the ability to make those decisions. This year, I've been abroad twice on Spring's money to go and close deals. Probably going to do a bit of filming next month on Spring's money because we want to secure that. We made a film last year called Meeting Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time in negotiation with Gorbachev's foundation, and we were still trying to get the finance completed when we got the agreement that we could film. So I paid for the team to go and film Gorbachev. Now, one thing I really didn't want was to wake up the next morning and find in the obituary column that we'd missed our opportunity. So it's a very calculated risk business. Mm-hmm. I would never make a stupid, I hope, decision. We would have never invested in a crew in Russia and flying Werner Herzog and Andre out there if we hadn't had a really good sense I was going to be able to sell this film. And we were good and lucky, and we did.
It's a pretty safe bet with Werner Herzog and Gorbachev.
Funnily enough, it's not always. Werner is a very interesting character, not only to work with, but also to sell. Because a lot of people love to say, oh, I'd love to work with Werner Herzog, that's amazing. And then you say, great, give us some money. And they go, oh my God, it's a Werner Herzog film. We can't do one of those. It's too wild and crazy. So we get a lot of interest, but then it narrows down to only sort of a relatively small number of people who actually feel that they can invest in a Werner Herzog film.
Meeting Gorbachev is a feature film, and like questioning about maybe the type of documentaries that you produce. So you have feature films, but in your portfolio are also other types.
Absolutely. We are completely agnostic into what we make. I only divide it into two, good or bad. We've made 5-minute films, we've made 105-minute films, and we've done pretty much everything in between. I think it's almost harder to make a 5-minute film than it is to make a 105-minute film because you're trying to cram so much more into that 5 minutes. We've made a name for ourselves over the last few years about doing feature-length documentaries. We make big, challenging subjects. We take on shows that no one else will take on. And because we've been successful, relatively successful, we've now built up quite a nice sort of reputation that when we say we think we can do it, that we probably can, and we get entrusted to do so. And these are expensive, they're difficult to do. The pacing of a feature-length documentary is very, very different to an hour-long documentary, and the subjects themselves can be much more television unfriendly, I would say. I think more and more and more you see on television, we're being pushed into smaller and smaller areas that we're allowed to make films about. Everybody's just chasing that audience. It's diminishing like crazy because they've all gone off to watch Netflix and Apple Plus. So we enjoy much more the freedom that we get in making the longer form. For instance, we did a film for Netflix a few years ago and the contract said it had to be longer than 80 minutes. That was it. If we wanted to make it 110, that was fine. If we wanted to make it 94, that was fine. And so the creative freedom of that is pretty amazing. When you work for television, you're told it's 47 minutes and 23 frames. Take it or leave it. You work for American television, it's quite often 42 minutes and 21 frames. They say, all right, we'll give you leeway. You can have 12 frames extra, you know. But you have to use those as creative disciplines, and it's fine. But the freedom of being able to make your film at the length that you feel is fitting for it is terrific, and we really enjoy that. And they will invest in films that do take a long time to make. The film we did for Netflix took a year and a half from first day of shooting to delivering the product. Television rarely allows you that luxury.
So what are some of the examples of the films that you've recently made?
Currently, we have, again, a pretty mixed portfolio, which we love. I'm doing a three-part series on women's prisons, which is a follow-up to the three-parter we did for Channel 4 last year on men's prisons. We've only cut two of the three episodes. We're cutting the third as we speak, and that will go out early next year. We're doing a one-off for Channel 4 under their first cuts, first new directors they work with. They used to do it first-time directors, and now they're using people who don't have a lot of experience. And we've taken on a very good director who has been allowed, which is so often the way now, she'd been allowed to shoot a lot of things and direct. She'd been allowed to edit a few things. She'd never been allowed to shoot and edit all the way through. And that's becoming very much of the moment, and not something I'm a great big fan of, that they split up. You have half a dozen self-shooting producers or APs in the field feeding into a cutting room, and somebody else, the showrunner and an editor, will take over and make the film, never having even necessarily met the crew, and the directors in the field never or rarely meet the editor. And I don't think that's great for good filmmaking. And so it's been really interesting working with this director and taking her through the whole process. And I think she's learned a huge amount in that process about, I came up through the camera route myself and went on to direct and produce, so I was pretty lucky that I'd been there in the field. But I tell you, there's nothing like learning how to make a film when you sit in the cutting room and go, where's the cutaway? Oh, we didn't shoot it. You only do that once or twice, and then you start to learn how to make your own films.
So to make these high-quality productions, you must have a team of and a company of 100 people. So, like, how big is Spring Films and how do you operate?
Well, it's difficult to count them all, but last time I looked, there was 9 of us. No, we're not a big company. The thing that will kill you as a business and more than anything else is overheads. You cannot afford these days to have people sitting around earning a paycheck, taking up office space and not generating money for you. So we expand and contract. We have 9 full-time staff. I'm currently employing about another 9. So that's 18 of us currently being employed by, but they're out in the cutting rooms or they're shooting. They're not here in the office.
What kind of roles are those, Richard?
Directors, camera people, editors. Because we work on quite long-term projects, my editor on the Women's Prisons show, we're employing for 7 months. You know, so he will be de facto a staff member whilst we cut these programmes.
In terms of long-term members of staff, though, what kind of roles would they be?
Heaviestly weighted area is in our development team. Yeah. We have a head of global development, we have a development producer, and we have a creative director. And those three spend almost all their time coming up with ideas, selling ideas, getting the teasers made, getting the written treatment sorted out, trying to track down people to appear in the programmes, you know, have we got a good idea, et cetera, et cetera. The rest of us are, you know, I run the company, I have head of production, we have a research AP, we have an office manager, and we keep it as low as we can. The lower your overheads, the more risks you can take. I've seen it many times, when you get the larger a company gets, the quality tends to drop off of the work they do because they have to feed the machine. And so you don't turn anything down, you just do films because it's a revenue source and you've got to pay the huge wage bill tomorrow. I've run companies. I used to be the head of the History Channel a decade or so ago, and we had about 115, 120 people working there. Wow. So I know what it's like to, you know, look at a monthly wage bill that is quite frightening. And I much prefer being
lean
and nimble and able to make decisions. We have a terrible business motto here at Spring, which is never make a film you don't want to watch. And
that's a good motto, isn't it?
We could make a lot more money by turning out crap. Yeah, I don't blame others for doing it, and good luck to them. I've seen some great crap. But those 26-part factual entertainment, semi-reality shows are massive earners. I don't want to go and make Love Island 4. Not that anyone would ask me, but that's not what I joined the film industry to do. So we're quite pleased to be able to be more boutique, to select the programmes we want to do. As I said, they're really challenging, some of these shows. And I can't imagine wanting to work for 18 months, 2 years on a project and not be able to tell your mum it was going out the following week because you're not that proud of it. Now, we don't always make truly stunning, brilliant films. We try to. But the vast majority of the films that we do, I'm always proud of. I'm very happy to say we did that. I'm proud to have been part of it.
How do you decide on that? Like, how do you decide if a story is really worth making it? You just said it, like, okay, it's a story I want to watch. I want to see it's a film I want to
see. I think it's almost as simple as that. Let me give you an example. We are currently just finishing a show, which is almost unique. About a year and a half ago, a Chinese producer and director came to us. And the Chinese director is a journalist from a town in China, not Beijing, but one of the smaller towns. He had been writing an article about the gay community in this town. And he'd met this one particular guy who was about to begin the transition to female. Mm-hmm. And they became friends. And he filmed him going into her for the next 17 years.
Wow.
And they came to us coming up 2 years ago and said, we've got thousands of hours and a lot of a very interesting but odd rough cut. What do we do? And we looked at it, myself and Andre, and we showed it to everyone in the company. And everybody in the company just went, wow, that's amazing. That story is almost unique. You never normally get to see that period of time covered. And it was shot on VHS, it was shot on digital, it was shot on every format going. And we decided to take it under our wing. We raised the finance to bring in an editor. We flew Gia, the director, over from China. We got it online, graded, dubbed, and it's just about to hit the markets now. And again, I'm hugely proud of it's called The Two Lives of Liu Mao. And it's just a really moving film. And everybody in the office, even though the rough cut was not good, we all could see the potential in that project. My job here at the company is to be the guy who says no. And I'm the one who has to turn down a lot of ideas because I'm lucky. I've come from both a practical filmmaking background. I used to be a director and producer, but also I spent 10 years as a broadcaster. I was a commissioning editor. And I always force everybody to see it from the commissioning editor's viewpoint. The biggest challenge we have with people who come to us with ideas is that, sadly, being a good idea is no longer good enough. We have to look at all the reasons why the commissioning editors could turn this down and find the reasons why they could not possibly want to turn it down. It's a challenge. 20 years ago, quite often, if you just had a really interesting idea, I once pitched an idea to Channel 4 about superstring theory, which is quantum physics. It's called the grand unification theory, where everything in the universe is connected. And I still remember the phone call came in from Channel 4 saying, yeah, great, go ahead and do it. And we all went, oh, shit, you know, what do we point the camera at? But they liked it because it was a good idea. That programme would never be made today, not without us getting Brian Cox attached, the permission to film in Buckingham Palace, or you need all of these extra added elements, the commercial elements of the film. When I was a commissioning editor, an easy choice for me to commission a film is if I thought it was an original, interesting story that could get me a double page spread in the broadsheets, or even the tabloids. If the Daily Mail ran a two-page, centre-page article about your film, that added 250,000 people watching it the following day.
Something sensational is what you're looking for, yeah.
Yeah, but sensation not in a pejorative sense. It's got more in the sense of, wow, that's interesting, rather than tabloid sort of sensation. That's why all of those tropes are useful. For the first time, never seen before, archive recently discovered.
Yeah.
All of those things help a commissioning editor because they know they can sell that, and that's what gets you your audience. Whatever anybody says nowadays, we're all being driven by the audience. There was a time where it was thought, well enough, you know, if your film was highly respected, looked nice, did the channel credit, that would be good enough. Those days are long gone. We have to be driving numbers. If your programme, however worthy, doesn't matter how many awards it wins, if it's staying 600,000 overnight, you're not going to get the second series. They're forcing you, and we all subscribe to this, to go on and really try and attract an audience. And a lot of ways to separate the bad ideas from the good ideas, or, to put it another way, from the ideas that are likely to get commissioned to the ones that aren't going to get commissioned, is an understanding of who the audience is that will watch it. I used to run the Biography Channel, amongst other things, and people quite often say to me, I've got this fantastic idea. Very few people have ever heard of my great aunt Lucy. And I go, sadly, unless your name is Paddington, you know, that's going to stay that way. You know, there's nothing there. Even though your great aunt might have led a really interesting life to you and your family, that's not going to get a million people watching it. They've got to be something there that drives the audience. And that's because we still see quite a lot of filmmakers whose ideas are set in the 1970s, 1980s, where we had three or four channels. And therefore, if you didn't want to watch sport and you didn't want to watch cooking, then you watched the documentary. And they got amazing audiences. Documentaries in those days would pick up 8, 10, 12, 14 million viewers. Now there's 400 and something channels out there. You've got to absolutely fight your corner and get... And that's excluding the SVODs, the Netflixes, and now the Apple Pluses and Disneys. So you've really got to have something that sells and is not just a nice idea anymore. Sad, but that's the reality of what we now face.
So just take a step back. You employ a team within the company to develop the documentaries, to come up with something that is going to be popular enough to be successful, whether that's a film or TV program. But you also get people approaching you to get support with their own projects, and then you take them on. It'd be good to understand how many of those kind of independent projects do you pick up and support as a company in relation to how many you actually develop on your own. And then it would be good to understand a bit of the process around how you work with those independent people as well.
There's no rule. You know, we don't say it's got to be 60-40 or 70-30. Everybody's looking for the next good idea, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. You know, so if our receptionist says, oh, I've got this brilliant idea for a film, and you go, oh, my God, that is a brilliant idea. Brilliant. We'll do it. Yeah, we're not looking for fanfare lights to arrive and this is it, the great idea. It varies, but I would say we see between about 10 to 20 ideas a week between us all that just get sent to us at random.
Just via email?
Just via email. People have seen something we've done. And I would say, hard to tell, but the vast majority, certainly, we can't do. They're unrealistic. They don't have an audience. They miss their opportunity. That you quite often you'll say to someone, and I had this experience a lot when I was running channels, you go, yeah, it's a really good idea. And if you watch BBC Two, it's on this evening at 8 o'clock. Come in way too late. You know, when I ran the History Channel, people would say to me, did I know it was the anniversary of the start of the Second World War next month? Yes, funnily enough, I did. And I commissioned a program a year ago about it. You pitching me 4 weeks ahead of the transmission isn't going to do it. So we're looking for things that do work, tick all those boxes. First and foremost, we have to believe it's going to be a good film that we want to watch. You know, as I said, that's our sort of business ethics and motto.
Does it have to be a film?
No. We've done 5-minuters. We've done currently doing a one-off 1 hour, a 3 1-hours. There's very little market for half hours at the moment, which is a shame because it's an interesting format. There's not that much of a market for one-off 1 hours. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's probably the hardest single thing to get commissioned. We turned down a lot of those ideas because you cannot get a commissioning editor to say, we'll do a one-off 1 hour. Gone are the days where they used to have strands, what we used to call strands, like 40 minutes, Equinox. Things where you could do a one-off idea and it would fit into that strand. Those pretty much died out. So we're almost always asked for television for 3 parts and beyond, and 6 parts. And I've seen a lot of good ideas ruined where you have a really clever 1 hour and they say, oh no, we wanted a 3-parter or worse, a 6-parter. People spend months working on it and you go, oh no, that's far too thin, it doesn't work. And you can't do that. We've had that experience ourselves where we've taken good ideas to the broadcasters and they go, we love it, we definitely want to do it, but we want it as 6 parts, not 3 parts. And you go, oh God, no. Because you know it will be a thin 6-part, but a pretty good 3-part. But those are their rules and they've got the money.
Worked with this great variety of amazing filmmakers. I think it's a pretty safe guess to say that all of our listeners will know Werner Herzog, but also independent filmmakers that you've taken on. You just gave us an example. So let's say I'm an emerging filmmaker, done a couple of short films, bringing you my first feature film project, my idea. The topic is great. You think that as well. I'm invited to your office. What do I do next? What do I prepare? What questions do I have to have very clear to sell it to you?
I think it's 2 things. You have to believe fully in your film, but more importantly, be realistic about what your expectations are for your film. It's a tough world out there. If you are really a first-time filmmaker, no matter how good your project is, it's unlikely that someone's going to give you $2 million as you're a first-time director.
So do they approach you for money or support?
Both, everything. Yeah. We help finance. There's a term in the industry called an umbrella company or a godfather. We work quite a lot like that. We get asked by broadcasters. They'll say, someone's brought us this really interesting idea. They've only made half a dozen short films before. Will you work on it with them? Will you look after them? And that's the ones that we're quite interested in doing. We've turned them down because I won't name names, but someone came to see us and said, oh, here's quite an interesting film. And we went, yeah, that's interesting. I said, what do you think it's going to take to make it? And she replied, about $3.5 million. And I went, not for us. No one in the world is going to pay $3 million for a film by a first-time filmmaker. So what you're trying to do is make sure that they're realistic. No one is going to pay you £250,000 as a first-time director. No one's going to give you 2.5 years to make it.
Damn it.
And you're going to have to accept that you will have to compromise your vision, because filmmaking is compromise. The best filmmakers compromise least and best. But everybody, from Werner Herzog downwards, everybody makes a compromise. The only time your film is perfect is when you complete the treatment or the script. Next day, you start making compromises because it turns out so-and-so isn't available, you're not actually allowed to film in the Oval Office. So all of those things start to change your vision. And the people who get stuck in that can only see what they originally came up with are very difficult to work with. Now, my job is to help them make the best choices that they can to get the best film you can, but it won't be the film that you originally started to make. You have to have a beginning, you have to have an end, But how you get there is going to change down the road. And if it doesn't, you're probably not going to make a very good film or go and make a drama. Mm-hmm. Documentary, you just have to keep your eyes and your ears open, and the twists and turns in the road occur every single day. You know, if we can't do that, can we do that? My philosophy is if you come up against a wall, you dig under it, you go over the top of it, you knock it down, you find a door, you look to the left, but you just don't stand in front of the wall and say we can't go any further. But you're not going straight ahead, so you've got to find another way. So it's finding people who are able to adapt, who will accept that their film can be made better by others. We try very hard, and it's a difficult balance, not to take over anybody's film. They're the director or it's their film. There's a commercial reality to it. We look at films and say, that's going to work so much better if you move that to the beginning and that there. And I've been in that exact position myself in the cutting room where, you know, my commissioning editor has come in and said, oh, that bit doesn't work. And you go, yeah, but it took me 4 days to film and we crashed the car and the camera assistant had their legs bitten off by a polar bear. Yeah, still doesn't work though, does it? Yeah, but, all right, it doesn't work. Yeah. And it's learning to kill your baby is a big part of filmmaking. The audience never knows what you don't show them. And I've seen battle, and I've been involved in battle after battle, where not till the very last dying embers do you get rid of something that is now, was brilliant 4 months ago, doesn't fit in your film anymore. So it's finding people who want to work cooperatively.
Have you ever missed out on a big opportunity because they just weren't willing to budge on what they wanted in terms of support? So is there one that got away from Spring Films that you can think of?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I'm happy to say that no film that we turned down I've ever seen make suddenly think, damn, it won the Oscar.
Which must be a nice feeling.
Access to Godzilla. You know, I come with that and I'm like, no, I'm directing that film.
Because there's no point in us taking on a job and not being able to do it. And if you say, if I'm not directing it, it can't be done. Okay, good luck to you. Admire your ambition, but I'm not going to raise $1 million on you. Other people walk in and say, okay, yeah, that's fine, of course you can direct it. You know, and yes, I think we can raise $1 million for you. But the same goes for a straightforward television documentary. Television isn't cheap. The budgets go from 80,000 to $250,000 at the top end, maybe a bit more. But at those levels, the channels do not want to give. I was a commissioning editor. It's actually quite nerve-wracking when you sign off a contract, be it for £200,000, £300,000, 6 months later, you go into a cutting room and you think, Christ, this better have worked. You don't want a crap film, you know, because you report to your lords and masters how you spent their money. So it's all about finding people who can take on and work and develop and grow rather than say, here it is, take it or leave it, I'm an artist. I have very little time for the fixed, solid opinion.
And by adapting, you also mean, you mean it in all senses, in terms of story, in terms of format, everything.
Yeah, it's being able to, and that's a hard thing to do, but it's being true to your vision, but being able to work with the tools and the funding and the processes that are put upon you. I've been doing this a long time, and I believe in there's no business like show business, but I'm very heavy on the business word because my job is to make sure we're here to do the film next week. Mm-hmm. Anyone can make an amazing one-off film, but that's no use to me. I've got to be, you know, it doesn't matter if you go 50% over budget, how do I pay for that? Because I'm busy trying to fund the next film. For me, it's very much, it is a business proposition. You've got to understand how it works. Now, that has no limits, or, on my opinion, on your creativity or the power of the film that you make. And I think we can prove that with some of the work we did. I love a challenge. We did a film called Night Will Fall a few years ago, which was about the liberation of the concentration camps. It's primarily in black and white because we followed the story of a film that was made but never shown. And it's very tough viewing, and there's some really gruesome things in it, and I was told at least 20 times that we would never raise the money to do a film primarily in black and white who was interested in it.
It'll never happen, Richard.
Never happen. It's about the concentration camps, been there, seen it, done it. In the end, we found 9 separate financing partners, all of whom thought they had should have editorial control. And he said, utterly immodestly, it won us an Emmy, it won us a Peabody, it won us a Royal Television Society Award. And as far as we know, it's been now seen by about 60, 65 million people. So I'm proud of that. So never, never think that the limitations are going to stop you achieving a creative and a vision. It's just working, manipulating those limitations into something that you can turn into the film you wanted it to be.
So if I'm an independent filmmaker, I come with you with the idea, you're happy with it, you think this is something that Spring Films can help sell. On a practical level, what happens next? So do you set up a meeting with that person? Do you go through the contracts? There's 10 contracts you have to sign.
We keep it all very simple. The first thing that will happen is if we agree we all want to go forward, we draft what's called a memorandum of agreement, an MOA, occasionally called an MOU, memorandum of understanding, but it's the same thing. And that is a 2-3 page document that lays out what we've all agreed about who's going to do what to whom. Very rarely mentions the amount of money involved, because it'll just say for fees commensurate with the final budget. Mm-hmm. But it lays out who owns the copyright, who will have final editorial decisions, who will be raising the money. But we keep it as simple as we can. Never done one that's been more than 3 pages. I normally keep them to 2 pages. And then if we all agree that, we both sides sign it, and then we start the search for money and we start the search for a broadcaster. That can take years, to be honest. We've had projects that we've got commissioned instantly. When we did the prison series last year, it took me a year and a half to get access to the prison. And we were the first film company to be allowed to film in an English or a Welsh prison. The Scots have slightly different rules. For over 7 years, they just put a ban on it. The MOJ says no camera crews inside prisons. When we got in, we couldn't shoot a teaser. We had nothing, but I managed to get the governor of the prison to do a short piece to camera, telling us why he thought the film was going to be important and that he would agree to it. I walked into Channel 4 and I said, I've got the keys to Durham Prison. And they went, it's a commission. When do you want to start? It can be as long time in the setup, but we got commissioned in 48 hours. We've got other shows that we've had commissioned after 2 years, because timing is right. You can go to the broadcasters and say, oh, I've got this amazing story about India. And I've been told, oh, we did India last year.
Yeah.
Oh, what? All 1.1 billion people is done now.
Yeah.
Yes, we're not doing India for another. Go in 2 years later and they'll go, brilliant, we haven't done India for 3 years. Timing is very much part of the issue. They might have commissioned something quite recently. Yeah, I remember getting 49 proposals to celebrate Henry VIII's 500th anniversary, 48 of whom assumed I'd stolen their brilliant idea. But it's the person who came in first with the best idea that you wanted to make. So normally I would say it takes between about 3 to 6 months before we know what's happening. And that is everybody has turned it down, or actually we've got a hook in someone's top lip and we're reading them in. And depending on the scale of your project, you can be shooting quite quickly. The film we're working on at the moment, when we took it to Channel 4, we shot a tease. And there, I'll give you the full routing of it. We took it to the BBC. They said, great idea. And we asked for some development money, and they gave us a bit of a development money, and we spent 3 days filming. And then we took it to the BBC and they said, oh, we've been told not to do any more shows like this for a bit. So thank you, but no thank you. So we said, all right, we'll take it back. So we showed the same tease to Channel 4, who went, oh, we can give you a first cut slot if you want to do that. And I think we were filming, actually making it 4 weeks later. So who knows? You cannot guess. Yeah, there is no formula that says this will take a week or a year.
And you gave me a brilliant idea. I just have to sneak in Peru into people's minds. So yep. It will be a modern country and everybody wants to talk about it. Everybody wants to make a film about Peru.
Absolutely.
Richard, another practical question maybe in terms of approaching you. So again, a filmmaker have this idea. You mentioned a couple of times a teaser, yeah. having a pitch. So what do I need to prepare on a very practical level?
The essence is just a really good idea, mm-hmm. because depending on what level you come to us, our job here is to help you make that teaser if need be. If you shot a teaser, great, it's a help. In the end, it's just a paragraph. And if you send us a compelling paragraph, we'll take it from there. You can come to us and say, I've shot most of it, like our Two Lives of Leo Mao. They'd filmed it. You know, we had no more filming to do. They had 17 years worth of rushes. We've just got a film about to go out about David Hay, the former world heavyweight boxing champion. David came up with this idea that he should tell the story of his life, because he is an absolutely fascinating character. Hired off his own bat a director and cameraman, mm-hmm. and started filming himself. And then they came to us after about 4 years and said, we've got 1,200 hours of rushes, what do we do? We looked at a lot of it and thought, okay, this is really interesting. I met with David on the condition that he had no editorial control, because you want me to make a hagiography about you, fine, pay me. If you want us to take a risk and turn this into a good film, tell us where we've got it wrong, but you're not going to tell us how to make the film. David agreed that. But then we had no idea what was going on with his bloody career, because he kept trying to get his world title back. And that went on for almost 3-4 years. And so we've only just finished the film. And it's a really fascinating... So 9 years in the making, 2,000 hours of rushes, you know, by a good DP, but someone who had never made a film before. So, yeah, we came in halfway through.
So they needed a company like you, Richard, to really...
editorial guidance. I said, look, I don't want to make a film for boxing fans. I want to make a film in its own right. It has to have what I call the Senna moment. If you've ever watched the Senna documentary, you might know the exact lap he crashes on, but you're still hoping he's going to make it. Mm. And I think we've achieved that. You know, I've seen the film 40 or 50 times now, and when I watched David's last fight, I'm still sort of standing on my feet. Go on, David, you can do it this time. You know, you can, oh, yeah. And we've shown it to quite a few people who don't like boxing, would never go to a boxing match, and we've had them in this cinema in floods of tears because it's so emotional and powerful and tells you a unique aspect of a world champion's life. So that's one extreme. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to put any money into it. We put a lot of time and effort into it. We'll get our return down sales down the road. We've got other shows where people just came in and started talking to us.
Is it not more than an idea, though, Richard? Because I suppose an idea is just an idea.
You have to know how you want to do it.
You have to know how you want to do it, but also do you not have to have something to give? So some really good access, for example.
All of those are your bonus points. As I said, a good idea is a good idea.
So I've got lots of good ideas.
Yeah. How so do you think that?
I think that, yeah. So I might be bombarding you, Richard, with emails with ideas.
I disagree with you. Yeah. But all of those are the pluses. Do you have access? Do you have talent? Do you have a unique element? Anniversaries are always good. 10th anniversary, the 500th anniversary, the unknown, undiscovered, for the first time, archive, never seen before, so-and-so speaks for the first time. All of those, as we were talking about earlier, are the ones that you use to sell the film. And if you've got none of those and no, just an idea, that's when you're going to struggle. Yeah, you have to... Especially for a company like us who gets probably 10 good ideas a week, we're looking for a good idea that we know we can build on. Prison, good idea. Do you have access?
No.
No. Okay, we're not doing it. Prison, you do have access. Yeah. We're in. That's different story. It's now gone a little crazy, and I should think every major company in the United Kingdom has a list of filmmakers who are asking for permission to do Harrods, IKEA, the Ritz. If you write to any of them, they say, oh, well, you're the fourth person this month who's asked if they can come and make a film about us. The skill of that is trying to be ahead of the crest of the wave. You don't want to be the second or third person to do the prison idea. Yeah, you want to be the first person. Mm. Tougher, that that's the ones that get a name and are more successful.
So do you actively try to stimulate filmmakers to approach you as well? So do you advertise or do you just...
No need. Yeah, we, myself and Figs and Kathy and Andre, we all speak regularly. Tomorrow I'm going... Thursday I'm going up to York to speak at the Aesthetica Film Festival. And we all like working with new people. We're all desperate, the same as everybody else, for good ideas. So why wouldn't we? Yeah, and it's more...
You don't need to right now.
We don't need to. No. If you look at our website, all our names and all our emails are there. It's, what's infuriating is that we get ideas sent to all of us. All nine people will get exactly the same email.
Sorry about that.
And the problem for them is that we all think one of the other eight is going to reply to it. Then they...
That was Paul selling his 20,000 ideas.
Yes, yeah. I'll have to stop doing that, Richard. Sorry.
So it is a question of just being focused and saying, I want to come and talk to you. I will always, if I've got time in my diary and someone says, can I come and talk to you about an idea, and if I think it's viable and it hasn't been done before or isn't about to come out on the Channel 4, I will try and make time for a cup of coffee. That doesn't mean to say I want 5,000 filmmakers suddenly going, here's an idea. You've got to really know that you how you want to make this film and what you want to make, because otherwise we can all waste a lot of time. It's a question of finding that balance between, I'm not expecting younger first-time people to come to me with a comprehensive, here's the budget, here's the schedule, this is how we're going to do it. That's what we do good. What we're looking for is people who really understand the market, understand the audience this film is for, and know who they want to get to with it. What's the story they're trying to tell?
Do you have another good example of that happening, Richard? Because I know that you recently premiered Cool Daddy-O at Sheffield Dockfest.
Yep.
And I believe that was by a couple of first-time directors.
It was indeed.
So could you explain what that film is and how that came about?
Yep. Cool Daddy-O is a very cool film. It's about a guy called R. Stevie Moore, who lives in America, who is the most famous musician you've never heard of, who has recorded over 400 albums in his bedroom and released them all, from everything from cassette to vinyl to over the internet. And it turns out he is an astonishingly good musician. And two women went off, read something about him, went to meet him and started filming with him. And they did this for about 3 or 4 months, got quite a lot of really interesting material. And then it turned out all the super cool artists, who I've never heard of, all revere R. Stevie Moore. Really interesting people say, this man is a god, he's just amazing. And they did some interviews with them, and then they were looking for somewhere to take the film to and trying to get it made. And they brought it to Figs in my company, my head of global development. And yes, everyone calls him Figs. His father was a greengrocer, but it's a long story. And again, same thing. We saw a lot of rushes and not a very good cut, but we all saw the potential in it. And we raised the money to bring in a new editor and to online dub and grade the film and get the audio sorted out. And it was quite complex because R. Stevie Moore is an interesting character.
So the directors had made something
already? Completely made it. We had nothing more to shoot.
Wow, and they just brought it to you and said, look, we've got this film.
Yeah.
We've got something.
Yep.
We want to elevate it.
We want to get it shown, is what they came down to. So we worked quite hard on it, and Figs put a lot of time into it. And it's now been shown at Sheffield. It got premiered in Nashville the other day with R. Stevie Moore in attendance. And we hope it's just about to be released on the world markets. But it just shows how varied the ideas come in. From prison, we were sitting around, we have sort of monthly, what should we do next, meetings. And I had read an advert that morning that said, come and be a prison officer. And I said, why would anyone want to be a prison officer? And none of us could answer that question, which is a pretty good starting point for a film. Mm-hmm. So we then spent, as I said, a best part of a year and a half developing various relationships and finally found someone who was brave enough to let us in and got it commissioned 48 hours later. So it can be as weird and wonderful as that, you know, that almost a completed film drops into our lap, or it's a piece of paper that you write down one line. Why would anyone want to become a prison officer? It's an immense satisfaction, I have to say. Like, probably 2.5 years after I wrote that down, you watch it go out on Channel 4 and someone gives you a nice gong for it. And even though my BAFTA was cruelly stolen by Louis Theroux and the police refused to investigate.
Damn Louis Theroux.
And that's, I suppose, the real pleasure and the thrill. Is when you take other people's rushes, you know there's something there, there's an inherent quality there, and bit by bit you craft it and you help them put it together as a film. And we flew our directors out, and Feeks went out to Nashville, and they had their moment on the red carpet.
Great fun.
Very exciting. And I think it's very important for us as a company not to... It's very easy to run over, crush someone's idea, because it's easier, it's faster that way. But we work very hard to make sure their film is their film. You know, we guide and try and get it the right way. But we always try and make it their film, not my film, not Figs' film, not a Spring film. We believe in their voice and we work hard to try and get that out, you know, in a way that can be the rest of the world can understand.
Have you gone on to work with filmmakers again as well? So they've had a successful project and then they come back with another idea and it's off we go again.
Hopefully we don't piss anyone off that much. I'm now working on my, slightly different, but I'm now working on my fourth Werner Herzog film.
Werner just keeps coming back.
Yeah.
Which I can only, I described to someone the other day, it's like hitting your head against a brick wall. It's so nice when you stop, you think you'll have another go. It's a challenge. Werner is always a challenge. It makes it exciting. But yes, no, it's, when I was a cameraman, I always saw that anybody could get, I could be get any job once. When a company hired me twice, I knew I'd been pretty good the first time. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer about that in the films that we make. If people want to come back and work with us for a second time, that's more of a success to me than if they come and want to and work for us for the first time.
Quite thrilling to know as a independent filmmaker that there are companies like yourself, Richard, who are so big and have such great access and great teams that you're there if I have a great idea and I need the support, that I can approach you and we can make something happen. And I think that's quite thrilling to know that you read every email that you get as well. And just to kind
amazing,
of...
Amazing, yeah, you have great stories as well. I think we could sit here and, like, talk to you for hours.
Can I just put a caveat on that?
Yeah.
As a commissioning editor, and indeed in my role now, I have written, I would think, over 5,000 emails that start, I'm sorry to be brutal, but... Because I've learned the hard way that honesty really is the best policy. And if you send me an idea in that isn't good or that I can't make work, I will have no hesitation in replying to you straight away, I can't do that, it can't work, it's not a good idea. So please don't think that was the...
If you're a delicate person,
But it comes down to that. So have a great idea, being able to adapt and working cooperatively. That's a new word I learned today. Thank you, Richard. So what else? Like, what other advices do you have?
It is a tough, tough business. And don't get disheartened because so much of this, as I was saying earlier, is about timing. It's luck. When we employ people, I'll get probably 4 or 5 CVs a week on average from people who want to be APs, researchers, things like that. Great. I have no problem with that. And when a job comes in, and we never know, you know, what tomorrow will bring, if I need next week an AP, well, the last person who sent me a good CV is probably the person I'll call first. The poor sod who sent me one 4 weeks earlier, you know, I'll go to the filing cabinet, but, you know, so it is so much. It's same for us when we pitch jobs, it's about timing. Is this what the commissioning editors are looking for? Is the zeitgeist right? Are they about to do a season on? Same when people get employment. It's much more the gods came together at the right moment and, you know, you were here. We run an intern program we've had for quite some time. And two of our interns, who we've been really impressed with, within months ended up, one, Alice came to us as an intern to see if she wanted to get into the film industry because she'd just come out of publishing and hated publishing. She did 4 weeks interning for us. 6 months later, she was in the middle of Kazakhstan calling me about the helicopter, which hadn't turned up yet as an AP. Rog, who came to us as an intern, and I think he was just came in for 3 weeks. As I speak, he's currently in Mexico working on his second Werner Herzog film. But they proved themselves. You know, it was nothing to do with us. They were people who we
were capable.
Capable, and we trusted and had the ability and enthusiasm. And the single most valuable property in filmmaking, which is common sense, that ability to not take defeat and just go on and get it done. And ideas, almost the same. If you, as a filmmaker, are passionate about your idea, you don't become totally insular and your idea is it above all else. And why aren't people interested in my pet cat? And I see people get really cross, you know, when you say, actually, I don't care at all about your pet cat. If they can absorb and develop and grow and learn, then we like working with them. I think there's very, very few people, I might make an exception for Werner, who deserves the credit, a film by, because I think a film is a team effort, it's a collaboration, and we love working with people who want to collaborate. If they want to be artistic arseholes, good luck to them. They can continue working by themselves.
Great advice. Thank you, Richard. I think we'll end things there because you have a business to run.
Damn.
So
I was enjoying this.
But I'm sure we'll be back in the future. So thanks a lot.
A great pleasure.
Thank you.